And now we come to the final part of the journey. Yes, right, Nibbana. I did ask actually just at tea time whether there was any fee for this session today. So because it was a free session, if you don't get to Nibbana, you can't ask for your money back. Which is why we don't charge a fee. So now we come to transforming your mind. This is like the wisdom part. I did try to split the session up today into sila, into the virtue, into meditation in the second session, and now the last session is wisdom, the insight, the understanding, the truth of things as they really are. Now, sometimes, you've got some questions? Very good, very good, okay. The questions, are they complaints? So, one interesting thing in one of the teachings of the Buddha, something I emphasize a lot in my talks in Australia and elsewhere, that when the mind is peaceful in meditation, you don't need to say, oh, I'm now going to do insight. The insight flows naturally from a peaceful mind, like compassion flows naturally from a peaceful mind. And there's one sutra I always quote, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya, it's in the nines, I think. There's some questions here. In that particular sutra, it says that for someone who has experience of samadhi, of the peaceful states of mind, they do not need to make an intention to form a decision, oh, may I see things as they truly are. It happens as a natural course, according to the Dhamma of cause and effect, that one who has peace of mind will see things as they truly are. And I quote that a lot because sometimes people think, oh, okay, now I've done samatha, now I'll do vipassana. You don't do samatha. I've already mentioned that. Samatha happens when you're not doing anything. And you don't do vipassana. You don't decide to do insight. If you're doing insight, you're missing the point. Insight happens, like calm happens. Now this is a very important point, because if you think you're doing things, you're going in the wrong direction. It's all Second Noble Truth practice, not the letting go practices. Which is such an important point that I spend a huge amount of time talking about that. The other way of describing meditation, which I have had great success in using, simply because it's a way of understanding what is going on, is actually to describe what we mean by the mind. Remember, this is like transforming the mind. To understand what we mean by the mind by splitting it into its two major functions. This is what the mind does. It has two main duties, two main responsibilities. The first thing which the mind, mind's responsibility, is to do things. To think, to manage, it's like the government inside of yourself, always making decisions and managing your body and managing your life, and very often managing other people's lives as well. I call this the doer, the manager, the controller. And I think you will be able to understand what I mean by that. Every time that you move your bottom, every time which you scratch your shoulder, every time you twiddle the knobs, every time that you put your hands over your eyes, every time you put up your cloth, you're doing something. Every time you scratch your head, you're doing something. I'm just watching what people are doing. You scratch your neck, you're doing something. Because this is the active part of the mind, the doer. The second part of the mind is the passive part of the mind. What I call the knower, or consciousness, or bare mindfulness. It's that which knows, that which can hear, which can see, that which can know, the knower. Now is it quite clear, those two parts of the mind? Because once you are familiar with what these mean, then I can go further, having made that distinction between the two halves of the mind, we could actually see what meditation is and what wisdom is. The point is that when a normal state of mind, we do so much, we know so little. Most of our energy, most of our concern is with doing things, with being active. and we know very little. We don't actually collect data, we just manipulate the world. When I say the doer, it means will, action, thinking, that's all part of doing. Bare knowing is just being alert, seeing what's happening, knowing what's happening without doing anything about it. Just looking, just observing. Now the point is that for most people, all our energy goes into doing, into willing, into choosing, into changing things, into managing our lives. That there's very little energy left to know, to be mindful. Which is why the person asked earlier, sometimes when I meditate, I fall asleep, I nod off. And I answered that question by saying, allow yourself to go to sleep, have a rest. Because what happens when you're sleepy in meditation, it means all your energy has been used up in the past by getting here, running around, doing things, clearing up your desk and your office so you're free to come here. You've been doing so much that your energy is very, very low. Now, if your energy is low and you get tired, you get sleepy, what should you do actually to overcome that sleepiness? If you start doing more things, trying to struggle and make war, have a battle with that sleepiness, you just make yourself more tired. You're doing too much and all the energy is being used up. So my answer, which I found out in my own practice, if you're sleepy, make peace with sleepiness. Don't do anything. Allow it to be. Say, sleepiness, the door of my heart's open to you. And when you're not reacting, when you're not doing anything, when you're not trying to change and manipulate your sleepiness, the energy which you have, instead of being all consumed by doing more things, by trying to control and manage things, all that energy is free to flow to just knowing, to awareness, to consciousness. It can either go to one half of the mind of doing, or it can go to the other half of the mind, just knowing. But when you stop all this doing business and just allow the energy to go into knowing, you find your mindfulness gets brighter and brighter. You literally wake up. And as you wake up, the mindfulness begets stronger and stronger and stronger. It's a strange thing to see mindfulness become so bright and so powerful. I've already mentioned one aspect of that is when you have your cup of tea or when you have your meal, it tastes much more delicious. Did you enjoy the cake at tea time? If you did, that was a sign you've been following my instructions. Well done. It means you've just been at peace with things and you have energy to feel and to taste things. You know what it's like when you're running around doing work? Sometimes you grab a sandwich here, you grab some noodles there, you stuff it in your mouth, you don't even know what you're putting in your mouth because you don't even taste it. Now, the point is here that when the energy goes into knowing, the knowing gets so bright, it gets so still, that you can become wise. It happens by its very nature, as you calm the doer, as you calm the mind, as the energy doesn't go into doing things anymore, which is the job of meditation, you start to see more things. You start to get insights. You start to gain wisdom. Wisdom comes from the calm mind. And this is how it happens, that mindfulness gets stronger. Sometimes it's like, you know, you've got a dull flashlight and you can't really see what's happening. But when you get some new batteries and you can have a powerful flashlight, you can see everything. Everything gets illuminated. This is what I've called power mindfulness or superpower mindfulness. Where the mindfulness, because it's empowered by still states of mind, having the energy just going into knowing, the mindfulness gets so strong you can really see things. It's like if I turn the lights up into this room, you can actually start to see some of the grey hairs in some of the girls. You can start to see some of your pimples. You can start to see the false teeth in the men. Whatever it is, when you turn up the lights, you tend to see much more. This is what we mean by wisdom. It happens by its own nature when mindfulness becomes strong. So by transforming the heart, we naturally go on to the next stage of transforming the mind. One of the things which we see when we transform the mind by wisdom is just how little we truly own, how little we really do control. Because it's a great saying of the Buddha that people who have big egos have lots of possessions. People with small egos have little possessions. People with no egos don't possess anything at all. I don't mean just how big your house is or how much money you have or how many things you have. That's not what I mean by possessions. I mean how much you're truly attached to. Some people can only have a small few things, but they're really possessed to it. Now, they really have a lot of possessions. Only it's small things, but it's intense. I know some people are very, very wealthy, but they're so kind and generous. They have many things, but they have few possessions. They share things. So people with big egos, what they have, it's mine. And the Buddha actually said, where there's a mine, there you will find a me. There you will find the ego. And you actually, a lot of people define themselves by what they own, by what they possess. And what you possess, you tend to want to control. That's my house, that's my car. Some people have such big egos, they want to control their husband or their wife. They want to control their family. They think, that's my wife, that's my family. But as you become wise, as the insight gets very, very strong, you realize how little you really own at all. No, truly, is that really your husband? Do you really own them? Can you really say it's my husband? Or are you just renting them for the time being? Really, it's much closer to rental, isn't it? Because you only have them for a time. And then you have to give them back again later on. Marriage is called rent-a-husband, rent-a-wife. Joint venture, yeah. So what it means here is that when we actually see with wisdom how little we own, we truly own, we can actually enjoy our family, but we don't own them. We don't possess them. They actually come into our lives for a short time. We know they're going to leave later on. We can enjoy them while they're here. We can let them go when they have to leave. I know lots of people, because of the illusion of ownership, because we really think that we own our children, we have so much suffering with our children. Really, who do your children belong to? Are they really yours? The point of the matter is that they're just beings who come into your life. You don't know where they came from. They just arrive in your womb one day. And there's a being coming from a previous life with all its old karma. And they come into your life. And you give birth to them, you nurture them, look after them. And sometimes I've seen in Australia and also Singapore, Malaysia, some wonderful parents have monsters for children. They get, they can finish their schooling, they talk back, they've got lots of big discipline problems, and they cause so much trouble. And sometimes they come and complain to me, what did we do wrong? We did everything we possibly could for our kid, and our kid's in trouble with the police, and always talks back to steals from us. What did we do wrong? I say, of course you did nothing wrong. Now, even the best garden, if they got a poor seed, they can't make a nice plant or flower out of it. You tried your very best. You had just a bad seed, that's all. It's not your child. It's not your son, not your daughter. They came from another life. You gave them a body, you nurtured them, that's all. They're there for you for a time being. But please, don't try and own them and think they're yours. The opposite has happened many times too. I've seen parents who are hopeless parents. They don't care for their kids. Sometimes they're cruel. Sometimes they abuse them. And sometimes these children, they just grow up to be amazing people. Just so kind and so intelligent. They get scholarships here and they get degrees and they have a wonderful life in spite of their parents. And sometimes, again, using the plant analogy, sometimes these wonderful seeds, and it doesn't matter who the gardener is, they have no gardener. Sometimes it grows and it becomes a beautiful flower, even without any nurturing. So sometimes you might think, you know, is that my child? Or is that somebody who's come into my life who I'm looking after for the time being? If you realize it's not yours, it's just a responsibility, a person visiting your life for so many years, then it's much easier to let them go. I know that some mothers and fathers have a terrible time with their children. They worry about them and worry and worry and worry. And I am now 53 and my mother still worries about me. And I think, you're crazy. And I tell them, people like that who worry about their children, you should be like a bird. Like when a bird, two birds come together and they have their eggs, that one of those birds sits upon those eggs for day after day after day. And if you think you've got a sore bottom sitting on that's nothing compared to sitting on a round egg all day. But they do that because they love their little children. And then when the egg hatches, they have to go searching for food all day. No matter how many worms they catch, that little bird still wants more. And it's an endless task feeding those little chicks. And when those little chicks are big enough, the mother and the father teach them how to fly. But this is where the birds show their wisdom. As soon as their young can fly and feed themselves, right, that's it, you look after yourself now. And mum and dad go on holiday, they never come back. Wouldn't that be wonderful if you could do that? You look after your kids, you feed them, give them education, once they finish university, out the house, you get your own house now. And you don't worry and care about them so much anymore. Why are we so attached to our children? You know it causes you a lot of pain and suffering sometimes. It's because of ownership. We think that this is mine. It's my son and my daughter. What wisdom says is actually we don't own these things. We have duties. When we fulfilled our duties, that's enough. We don't own them. It's the same with your husband, your wife. You don't own your husband, your wife. You do your duties and that's it. If they die, you let them go. It's the same with your body. Do you own your body? Is that yours? If it was yours, you'd be able to control it. Oh, may I not be sick. Sometimes sickness comes at the most embarrassing times. I don't know about you, but I know many of my monks sometimes have been very, very sick and I made an appointment to go to the doctor. And as soon as they walk into that doctor's surgery, they start feeling well. Sometimes the body is completely out of our control. And when do you want to die? Have you got a nice appointment so you can say, well, it's not really convenient on Thursday, maybe on Friday, maybe next week sometime. Of course, you can't make appointments like that because the body doesn't belong to you. Who does the body belong to? It belongs to nature. So what wisdom shows us when we're very still, we just see how little we truly own in life. When we see we don't own these things, that's when we become detached. When I say detached, it doesn't mean we don't care. We care, but without controlling. We do our responsibilities and duties without thinking we own these things. In the same way, if you rent a car or you rent somebody's house, or if I am just staying in the BGF in my room upstairs, I don't think, ah, this isn't my room. I don't need to clean it up or tidy it up. I don't need to wash my own cups. I do that because I care. Because even though I'm renting this, I've got my duties. So even though you're renting your body, it's only there for the time being. You have your duties. But this evening when I leave, I'm not going to worry about that room at all. I'm going to let it go. As soon as this room which I live in, called my body, starts to fall apart, I'm going to let it go. That way, when you can let go of things, it's because you realize you don't own them. And when you don't own them, because of non-attachment, you can really let them go and be free. You transform your mind with wisdom, with non-attachment, with non-ownership. it's all the same of having no self, no ego. There was a question earlier about no ego, or big egos. And this part of ego, which I like to emphasize now, is actually encouraging yourself or praising yourself. Because I make a big thing in my talks about if you are keeping precepts, you deserve praise, encouragement. You deserve a sadhu sadhu. If you've come here today and listened to the Dhamma all day, give yourself a pat on the back. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Praise yourself. If you meditate and do well, give yourself a prize. And sometimes people have complained to me, look, if you praise yourself that way, won't you get a big ego? And the point is that no, you never get big egos by praising yourself. You get big hearts instead. You don't get big-headed, you get big-hearted. And that's a wonderful insight to have. Praise is like encouragement. And when you encourage yourself in things of goodness, you actually do, you get big-hearted. You get less selfish, less sense of ownership, because all the practices of virtue and meditation, they're all practices of letting go, renouncing, freeing yourself. So of course you cannot become more proud that way. It's not gaining more things, but letting go of more things. So we start to get wise. We start to see things as they truly are. We start to see how little we own in life. When you realize how little you own, when it comes time to death, death is so easy. I never own these things anyway. I came into this world with nothing. You came even into this world with no clothes. And so you leave with no clothes as well. Maybe. Certainly you came with no money, you can leave with no money. So what wisdom does, it actually frees you. So you're not worried about things which you don't own. Now when you own things, it's a burden. It's a worry. The other part of wisdom, which I like to emphasize, of transforming the mind, is we also realize through our meditation that we don't own the past and the future either. They're not ours. Because when you start to own the past, it's like you carry the great burdens of the past with you. Now when we think we own the past, that's when we can never forgive and let go of the past. Too many of us in modern life, we've had difficult things happen to us in life. We have had pain and arguments and people have mistreated us and haven't been very kind. And why do you allow that to destroy your happiness? Why do we carry around things which happened to us many, many years ago and imprison ourselves with the pain of the past? It never makes any sense to me. Because no one is forcing you to do that. You can let go of the past at any moment if you understand non-attachment. If you understand that this is not mine, it happened, and I let it go. I don't need to actually to attach and carry this around. What wisdom does, it frees you of those attachments. Also, I was going on about pride a minute ago and about ego. I was very impressed when I read some of the sutras of Buddhism to realize that what I thought was pride was only a third of it. In Buddhism, there's actually three types of conceit, three types of pride. And those three types of pride are, I am better than them. The second type of pride is, I am worse than them. And the third time is, I am the same as them. Because that all comes from measuring yourself against other people. And how can you ever measure yourself against somebody else? It's just like a school, like a school system. How can you measure, say, a child in grade 1 against a child in grade 11 or 12? Sure that the child in grade 12, just before going to university, can do so much more, they seem so cleverer than the child in grade 1. But the only reason for that is because the child in grade 12 has been in school much longer. They're not better. This is the same with human beings. You can never say someone is better or someone is worse. It's someone who's been practicing longer. Maybe they have had many, many lifetimes to practice, and other people are only just starting out in the human realm. So how can you actually judge someone is better or someone is worse? How can you judge someone as the best meditator, or the best monk, or the worst monk? Just that some monks have been practicing longer, that's all. So you expect them to know more and be more developed. Some people have only just started, so you expect them not to be so developed. The point is here, you're not judging people anymore. Some people will get more angry, but you don't see the rotten people, they're just learning. So give them a chance to learn. Don't judge them and say they're hopeless or rotten. So when we actually don't compare people, we're becoming very wise. We're not judging better or worse. And all this ego business of competition starts to disappear. And when we don't judge people better or worse, only then can we really have friends. So I ask you now, which is the best religion? Christianity, Buddhism, Hindu, or Judaism? Which is the best part of Buddhism? Mahayana, Theravada, which is the best vehicle? Somebody said many years ago, big vehicle, small vehicle. All vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. The point is that when we start to say that my type of Buddhism is better than your types of Buddhism, that's judging, that's conceit. That's missing the point of what the Buddha was talking about, of non-attachment, of non-ownership. So the point is that we have wisdom. And if it truly is wisdom, it is wisdom which never judges, which never thinks we're superior, or wisdom which never owns things, which can let things go, which can share. Why is it that people like to own things instead of sharing things? I can't see the point in that. There's plenty to go around if we could only share. But if we own it all by ourselves, then of course other people go without. Never makes sense to me. All because of the idea of ownership and self. When there's an idea of ownership and self, is my teacher is better than your teacher. My meditation is much better than your meditation. And we've got what this Tibetan monk once called spiritual materialism. How many retreats have you been to? 9. That's nothing. 99 retreats. I've been to 90 retreats. Beat that. Who's your teacher? Our teacher's Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, that's nothing. My teacher is whatever else it is. Sometimes we have that spiritual materialism, which I see in some of the disciples. I think, look, you're missing the point. We don't judge. You don't own things. You empty out. You let go of things. That's what wisdom means. Because with the emptying out of things, it's like you have less burdens to carry around in life. You don't have the burden of your teacher, of your religion to carry around. It's not a burden, it's a liberation. You don't have the burden of your possessions. How many people are possessed by their possessions rather than make use of their possessions? Are you really worried about all of your goods? There's this one fellow, one of these disciples. He only had one possession, which was a Harley Davidson motorcycle. It was actually worth about 60,000 or 70,000 Australian dollars. It was very, very expensive. And that was the only thing he had. He lived in rental houses. He only had a small number of clothes. He went from like small job to small job. But that was his pride and joy, his biggest possession. But he was a meditator, one of my disciples, and he told me one day, he went to the shopping mall, he parked the car, he got some goods, and when he came back to the car park, he noticed his motorbike had been stolen. And that was the only possession he had, $60,000 or $70,000. And as soon as it had been stolen, he remembered the Dhamma. It's not really mine anyway. Why am I going to make myself sad? It's been stolen, it's gone. All the crying won't make it come back. So he let it go. And he told me he was so proud of himself, he felt so good, that there someone had stolen the only possession he had, and he'd let it go. He abandoned it. He felt so good. And then he suddenly remembered he was on the wrong floor of the car park. because he went to the correct floor, his bicycle was still there. And I said, no, it must have been the Buddha who had actually changed the numbers of the car park just to give you a test. And it's such a great test for him, and he was so